today on ABCDTOS, Friday's Child.
Hello and welcome back to ABCDTOS, the podcast where we are discussing all of the Star Trek The Original Series episodes from, in alphabetical order, from All Our Yesterdays to Wolf in the Fold. I am John Engel.
I'm a Joe Amezel.
I'm Pete the Retailer.
And I'm Tom Taylor.
And today is Friday's Child.
Starring Ice Cube and Chris Tucker.
It's when they had the baby and they couldn't figure out. It's like Junior. It's like Junior with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
They had a baby made of weed.
How you get pregnant on your day off?
It's a Lego sequel. It's like, you know, bringing it back, the next generation. No, it's Friday's Child, the Star Trek original series episode. It's, depending on who you ask, again, it's season 2, episode 11, which is broadcast order, or season 2, episode 3 in production order. So it's early on. They really wanted to get out there and have everybody bake in the sun at Vasquez Rocks. Aired December 1st, 1967. And here's the Google blurb. Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and Dr. McCoy, everybody's got a different title there, face the wrath of the Capellans when they prevent the execution of the deposed High Tier's pregnant wife.
Sure.
Da-da-da-da. Yeah.
And, I'd watch that.
Yeah, it's another Klingon episode with no...
Is it?
Yeah, kind of.
A little bit.
I couldn't quite tell. They kept saying that guy was a Klingon.
Klingon. Well, I love that here we got our first, like, balding Klingon. So I was like, oh, is he one step towards the Worf, like, look?
Oh,
like,
he's about
the hairline's receding.
He's got the
virus or whatever.
Well, he's balding in most of the scenes, but we'll get to it as
we get to it. Yeah, that's true.
Not necessarily in action scenes. You're right.
Somebody who looks kind of like him gets stabbed at some point, but we'll get there.
I wouldn't go that far, Pete.
Somebody that's wearing generous. His clothes gets stabbed.
There we go.
Even his clothes, though, they're probably not. The guy probably wore an extra large.
True.
Just some dude.
Well, while we're here, so that it, I guess let's step through it. We'll get there. I wrote, here's a hell of a way to start an episode. It's just by having McCoy say they're quite large. I was like, oh, what are we talking about? But he's doing a slideshow like My Vacation on Capella, talking about the Capellans, who is a new race of people that. You know, we talked a lot about the Prime Directive last episode, and hard to, besides the fact they both start with F, we're going to have a lot of compare and contrast between last episode and this episode.
Oh, sure.
Because Bones is integral to both. Integral? Are we Canadian?
Either one.
No, we're mentally able.
So did they already break the Prime Directive? Like, was there contact with Capella before this? Capellans do not look capable of space travel. Was there accidental? I mean, I'm not judging them. It's just like they're most of their stuff seems very kind of, you know, Bronze Age at best.
Yeah,
right?
I was about to say they seem very early Iron Age.
Yeah.
It seems I had the same thing. I was like, no, wait, are they allowed to just go there and, like, you know, show them like they rejected they were uninterested in medical aid or hospitals.
Right.
You know, so like they were trying to give them stuff.
But
then it also, I forget what they said. There was some note that made it sound like they knew about the Federation, so that made it okay or something. But they knew about space travel. They didn't care. I don't know.
Bones has already been there, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay. Like, is it cool that he was there in the first place? Like,
yeah.
Or maybe that wasn't a Federation thing. I don't know.
Maybe he beamed down and said, behold, I'm the Archangel Gabriel. He's always dreamed of doing.
Yeah.
They couldn't do a Data from the beginning of Insurrection thing where they live in this like cloaked station or something.
But no, he clearly been interacting with them. Yeah. I don't know what again, going back to the cynicism of last episode, it's like, all right, well, Prime Directive is great unless we need your rocks. And then in that case, then we're just showing up with a full party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do we need their rocks? Is that why we're here?
Yeah.
Mining agreement. Mining agreement.
And the rocks are, they're it's altruistic. The rocks are the main component needed in life support systems for new colonies or something like that. So,
yeah.
And I have a question that just came to me that seems really obvious and would ruin the entire episode.
Oh.
Sweet.
The Federation has like an ethical core to it. They have a prime directive. They like to make agreements with people when they need something. Why don't the Klingons just kick their ass?
Who?
Why
the Federation?
The Capellans.
Oh, yeah, we got a Klingon down there who's like bartering.
He's already there.
Stuff,
why didn't they just wipe them out and take the planet?
All right, nuke the whole site from orbit.
Yeah, that's the only way to be sure.
Maybe since Organia, they're kind of the Klingons are like, now what if they're people made out of light? Let's just go easy.
Maybe we should talk.
Tread lightly.
Well,
yeah.
Well, then I mean, the Indochina metaphor wouldn't work.
Right.
But also, they did go and talk to. I mean, they took over Organia, but they did go. They didn't wipe them out. But I kind of wondered. The Klingons talk a big game, but they're not as genocidal as they would want you to believe. I think that they could have just come and just wiped these people out very easily, taken the space rocks.
Yeah.
And then what would the Federation do? You know? Yeah. So it's kind of interesting that they send like one envoy, like one guy.
One guy. Yeah.
It's
with maybe a ship nearby.
Is it very Klingon-y to do that? I don't
know.
Well,
you know what?
Well, the larger the landing party, the it is interpreted as a show of force. That
exactly.
is said within the episode. One guy is the smallest landing party you could possibly have.
But sending a landing party at all doesn't make sense for the Klingons to me. It's you just kick their ass. What are they going to do? What are they going to do? Like punch, like swing a dagger at you?
Yeah.
Like, who cares?
You just throw them up in the sky.
They're going to Kling at you. from...
I'm Klingat. Going to suggest and I'm what's up
Klingat. Go ahead.
I'm going to suggest, and this is me doing the heavy lifting, this is not stated in the show, but perhaps the Klingons deal with warrior tribes better because they could be used in the service of the Klingon Empire more so than, you know, agrarian cultures.
Right.
Oh, maybe because these guys are warriors, they sort of get them and dig them a little bit and want to deal with them on their level.
And they could be useful allies, potentially.
Yeah.
Some. Also, that they... I don't think that they need... Because if the Federation needs Topoline... Again, it's used for tooth polish. It's a rare mineral used for tooth polish. Topoline is vital to the life support systems of certain planetoid colonies. I don't think the Klingons are as concerned about that. The Federation is, you know, all that I know is filtered through the lens of Federation propaganda. But the Klingons don't seem like they would care that much about that. I think they more want this because in order to deny it to the Federation, and they more want to. You know, they're not going to send a whole thing. They're just like, go over there, see if you could disrupt that and prevent the Federation from getting that. It's not key. They're not desperately desiring the actual Topoline. They just want to mess with the Federation a little bit and have a thing. And whether the Federation,
I got the idea they did.
Seems like they genuinely want the rocks.
I mean, if these rocks are valuable to the Federation, then why wouldn't they be valuable to the Klingons? I don't. They seem to be. What did they say?
Life support is for babies.
Yeah, exactly. If you can't breathe in space, you're weak and you deserve to be destroyed.
Well, I don't know.
My life can't support itself. I need a machine made out of rocks.
They need machines
to
breathe.
Oxygen and food and water.
But anyway, it instantly raised a lot of questions about the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
Like, well, who initiated this? And since they weren't expecting Klingons, I'm assuming they don't know the Klingons are there. So they aren't showing up being like, we're here because the Klingons interfered. They're just showing up to be like, hey, how about those rocks?
Yeah.
Klingons are in this region, but let's not worry about that for now.
Exactly.
I'm sure that won't come up.
The other big question that's raised about the beginning of this episode is how they go about selecting their landing party personnel. Because it's very clearly stated how delicate this situation is, especially from the standpoint of aggressive behavior.
Yeah.
So they go, who's the youngest and least experienced guy that we could take with us?
Because we need that behavior demonstrated. Who can we do without when he flies off the handle?
Say, Bones, you were right. We brought old Youngin over here. Yeah. And
you are not exaggerating.
So it's Bones, Spock, McCoy, and not quite Jeff Ayers.
Right. It's like, give me Lieutenant Goofus. Let's bring him down.
Yeah. He's been annoying. Let's get rid of him just, in a productive way.
Kirk makes all these excuses for him. I forget. They say his name. I can't remember what it was.
Grant. They do. He's just a red shirt.
It's Grant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Grant. Mr. Grant.
He makes all these excuses for him, but every one of his excuses should have...
Very good, Tom.
Every one of his excuses should have... made him not be part of the landing party. Like everything he says, like, then you shouldn't have brought him to this really, really delicate situation.
He was a dumb kid. He flies off the handle every chance he gets. He's a scaredy cat.
The guy hates Klingons. He's a fly. He pulls his phaser. What do you want from the kids? It's like, Kirk, don't bring the kid. Like, he's just not the guy for this one.
That's our first crew death in a long time, by the way.
Oh, where are we at, Tom?
We're up to 18 dead crew so far, 15 of whom are red shirts, thanks to Mr. Grant here.
Mm.
Yeah.
Grant.
Here's another thing with...
red shirt Grant.
So Grant is played
by... But he dies in the first scene. Anyway, sorry.
Mm. He's a guy named Robert Bralver. Seems fake.
That's not real.
But...
Robert, that's fake.
Yeah. Mm. He's mainly a stuntman. But anytime there's like, so he's like a stuntman who can like, he can handle a line. So he's like that, like elevated stuntman.
A Klingon.
Yeah. So we
really
actually
handled that line.
See him in a handful. I think this is our first.
A Klingon?
Oh, no. This is not our first. So this is the first time that we see him as a crewman.
Mm-hmm.
Or as a, he'll pop up a couple of times on screen again, but we did actually see him again to tie these two Fs together. In For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, he was DeForest Kelly's stunt double. So in the fight scene, when they come out of the tubes and start punching the crew, that's actually Robert Bralver.
Wow.
And even like he continued to come back to Star Trek every now and again because he was a stunt performer in the motion picture. And he played an albino guard on an episode of Deep Space Nine.
Well.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and he's in Battlestar also. Who was he in Battlestar? There's currently no text for this bit. All right. So
tease.
He played somebody in Battlestar Galactica, apparently.
Supposedly.
79 Battlestar Galactica, I assume.
I have no idea.
It just says Battlestar Galactica.
Well, there's a link. It's like, oh, go check him out on the Battlestar Galactica wiki. And I did. And it's like, yeah, we don't know who that is.
Wow.
But I'm assuming it would be the original because it says he performed stunts in television series such as I Spy, Mission Impossible, Mannix. There we go.
Mm-hmm. Mannix.
Kung Fu Kojak Knight Rider, which is one show.
Kung Fu Kojak.
Kung Fu Kojak Knight Rider.
I love that show.
It was a cool show, but then they couldn't do merchandise because it abbreviates down to KKK. Battlestar Galactica and Diagnosis.
That's pretty
murder.
Good off the hip.
He's also a director. Oh, look at that. Oh, he directed episodes of Hardcastle Traffic. And McCormick, Riptide, Knight Rider, The A-Team, Rush Week, Jake and the Fat Man, Father Dowling Mysteries, Dragnet, and Renegade.
Wow.
And those first four were major television shows for me as a child.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Dang.
Oh, and he wrote several screenplays and stories for television, such as Emergency Peacemaster. And Kojak. And for the film Midnight Ride of 1990. Anybody know that movie?
It's a shame that he died so young, getting a Klev shoved into his gut.
It seems like it's the best thing that ever happened to him.
Klegat.
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 Sounds like look out when you yell like that. Yeah. So that's what you would be saying it's when good. You see the thing. That's how it got its name.
Let's see.
Look out.
Midnight Ride. I'm clicking on this now because I'm interested to see what...
Not Midnight,
Midnight
Run.
No, not Midnight Run. Midnight Ride.
Not Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, starring... Mark Hamill.
Oh,
I've heard of him.
And Michael Dudikoff.
I've heard of him.
And Robert Mitchum.
I've heard of him. All three of these people.
Yeah. And a handful of other people. Look at that. What a weird... A housewife just left her cop husband when she picks up Justin McKay. She'll wish she never did as she's plunged into a nightmare in the grip of a psychotic killer. Oh, gosh.
Oh, no.
So it's kind of like Devil Thumbs a Ride.
So are we guessing that Mark Hamill's the psychotic killer?
I don't know.
Oh.
Hmm.
I'd like to see that.
Mark Hamill, Justin McKay. Yep.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Right. He's got to be off the handle, right? He can't be just a cop.
Yeah. Maybe a cop on the edge. Who knows?
You'd have to really be on the edge. But I just can't picture. Has Mark Hamill
borderline
played
cop.
A cop? I can't even envision that.
No.
Seems
Wasn't
weird.
Wasn't he a cop in
MacGyver?
On desk
duty.
Was he in? I don't remember. I didn't watch that much MacGyver.
No, not MacGyver. The Guyver.
The MacGyver.
Yes.
Lieutenant MacGyvers.
Oh, look at that. He was in the Nude Bomb. Oh, let's just make the whole show about Robert Brelver.
Yeah, let's keep talking about it. I remember that. I was really under the wrong impression about the Nude Bomb when it was on.
That was a big disappointment when you're like a 10-year-old, 11-year-old kid with cable all of a sudden.
This is going to be a Nude Bomb.
Everybody out of the house. No, I'm watching the Nude Bomb.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, well.
So here's a, he was also in two episodes of Mod Squad, where he played a police officer and a guard. You know who else was on the Mod Squad?
A lot of people, but
Tiger Tig Andrews, who plays the Klingon Kraz in this one. Tig Andrews was the was Captain Adam Greer on like 123 episodes of Mod Squad.
Holy smokes.
Wow. Oh, wow. That many episodes of Mod Squad?
Out of curiosity, was Kraz actually named in the episode? I only remember him being referred to as Klingon.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too, Klingon. Actually.
And then you get Kligatted. I don't know if they say Kraz at any point.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kraz, of course, is the forgotten member of the Fugees. I'm torn on how I feel about Tig Andrews. First of all, if your name is Tiger, your given name is Tiger, why go by Tig? That kind of softens it.
Are we sure it's Tig and not Teague?
Yeah, well, his full name is Tiger.
Well, I mean, not sure, Tiger Man from Buck Rogers?
I don't think so.
Or Tiger Man from the Elvis song?
Or Puppet Man from the Tom Jones song?
Or Puppet Boy from the Devo song.
Back to the beginning.
Disco Boy?
Tiger Andrews was another one.
You are a Disco Boy, that's true.
I am. That you're talking to me. That's right.
He was on Chips. He was on Street Hawk. He was on Sledgehammer, Hawk. Misfits of Science. See, this guy hit a lot of good...
This is the audio.
A lot of these shows were a big deal to me.
Yeah.
Chips was a giant deal. Street Hawk was a giant deal for me. This guy.
I've gone on record saying that if I could live on a TV show, I think it would be Chips.
Oh, I
said that a long time ago, and I think I stick with that. I don't know.
It's always sunny.
I would agree to that if the theme song played every morning. That would be great. Mm.
Yeah, you wake up and that's just going on. Like whatever you do, it's to that song, and you're just that sets the mood for the rest of your day.
And once a day, you have to look over a cliff regretfully because a car just crashed down it.
Yeah,
that's a shame.
My instinct tells me that the show I'd want to be a part of is the show I would like to live in is the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Mm-hmm.
But then I sort of think, like, really, do I want my life to be secondary to somebody else? Mm-hmm. And also, it's cold in Minnesota.
It's snowing in almost every episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. They love to do that snow effect outside the window of her apartment.
Yeah. One thing that's actually pretty clever about that show, and we'll get off this immediately, is particularly in like the first two seasons, they do it seasonally. Like the first five or six episodes, there's no snow. There's snow in like the middle 10, and then in the back end, it's not snowing anymore.
Mm. Interesting.
That's enough MTM.
I will tell you that they're one of the most glaring continuity errors in the history of I have to tell you this. I might be able to find the video. There's a video there's a scene where Rhoda and Mary are having a conversation about somebody and they're eating food. They're having a meal at Mary's table. Mm-hmm. And then they cut to a close-up of Rhoda and a close-up of Mary. And then when they go back to the master shot, they're drinking coffee. Like, all in one sentence.
Nice.
It's, like, jarringly bad.
Wow.
Continuity.
Wow.
Anyway.
You found out that was intentional.
Rhoda says something, and it's, like, takes so long that they finished their meal, and they move on to dessert and coffee before she finishes the sentence. Anyway.
I want dessert and coffee.
Sorry, folks. Boy, we're really... this is, like, a week.
The Monkees. Hey, that's the show I'd like to live in.
Oh, there you go.
You know what show I'd like to live in the most? Star Trek, the original series.
That would be cool, because you could be on a spaceship and you could visit planets like this one, where the guy gets hit with a thing.
You might even approach
Capella 4. You would die are pretty high, though. That's the one thing.
Well, as long as you're not wearing the red shirt, you're fine.
done.
Right.
And, if you can catch the Krull thing, the Krull wheel. Like the one guy does. I don't know what point in this episode it is, but they decided for some reason to do a close-up of a guy getting supposedly like killed or at least severely injured by one of those. But it's a guy just like catching it.
Yeah.
Oh, my hands.
It's like, oh, geez. It's like Martin Landau and Ed Wood like moving octopus tentacles around.
Home.
Here's a note.
I have no home.
I wrote that there's a tense standoff after Grant gets Klingonned.
because he immediately wants to attack a Klingon.
Yeah, right. Which makes sense. I would have Klingonned him too.
Sure. Klingonny.
Jeez, guys. Where are we? We haven't even gotten out of the first 10 minutes.
Well, so there's this tense standoff because he gets killed, and then they're like, oh, you know, hey, why'd you kill my guy? And they're like, all right, well, we can negotiate, like, you know, give us your weapons or hand over your weapons or something like that. And they throw them on the floor. And I'm like, that's always like a dick move. Like, if you're like, all right, you know, hand it to me and throw it on the floor. That's like I would have, if I was the Capellans, I would have kicked them off. I would have killed them. I would have clicked out of them right there. That's like, you know, that's not handing them over. Come on. Yeah, I don't dig. You know what I do dig, though?
Who?
Cut back to the Enterprise and Chekhov as backup science officer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always a fan. Oh, yeah. I'm always happy to see that. Because obviously,
and his wig as science officer.
Yeah.
I do have to mention this, and we'll not get off onto another topic again. I happened to be watching this episode, and my son's mom was at the house.
Mm-hmm.
She school related things, and I was like, I got to watch this episode of Star Trek. So do whatever you want. And she saw Chekhov. She does not care about Star Trek, but she saw Chekhov, and she said, hey, they should have had a monkey. They should have had a monkey on one of these episodes. So like, hey, I got an idea. They should have brought the monkeys onto one of these episodes. I was like, boy, they were right on the money.
They knew what they were doing.
Right on the monkey.
Wow.
I spent a good deal of time watching this episode trying to figure out why Mab. The leader of the upstart leader of the Capellans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why he freaked me out so much. And about, like, you know,
the hat.
15 minutes in, I'm like, oh, he looks like Mike Pence. That's why.
Oh, my God.
That's true.
Like, that's funny.
Completely looks like Mike Pence. And then the rest of it, I was just like, yeah, Klee got that guy. it is a weird. I feel like this episode has I'm going to go off on this tangent because this is where my notes start to fall apart. Because I was like, I like the world building that they did here, and then it just kind of doesn't go anywhere. It's like, hey, look at all this new stuff, and then it just kind of floats. Mm-hmm. And then it's just like, especially kind of, again, compare and contrast For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky with Friday's Child. This is Joseph Pevney and DC Fontana. I was like, oh, you know what that last episode could have used is a little bit of this. And then I play this one and
Dream
I'm like,
team.
What's going on here? Did I get a snack? Like, let me go.
There's a lot of that.
There's like
everything on paper says this should be one of the great episodes you have, mm-hmm. but it's sort of like, and I don't want to jump ahead too much, but you have Julie Newmar.
Yeah.
Yeah, you
know,
sure
I
do.
Forgot about it until she showed up. I was like, oh, wow, right. Yeah.
Goddamn Catwoman, and it's sort of like, okay, so we have this statuesque dancer who's basically became a semi-household name about a year ago from a very popular TV show. Maybe you heard of it. It's called Batman.
Mm-hmm. Batman.
And I don't know, let's put her in as many clothes as possible and give her, like, a pregnant ball, to wear for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's just, and I like Julie Newmar and she can act just fine, but it's still like, why are you eliminating all assets this character has embedded in her?
Well, I don't know. I still find her extremely charming in this episode. I really like her in this. I think her calling McCoy
is
the most charming thing that happens in the entire series. I could listen to that all day long. I'm very endeared to her. Yes, she's all covered up, but what are you going to do? She's the wife of a whatever he is, whatever the title is. And she was on Columbo, so come on, give it a rest.
She is on the great Robert Conrad episode of Columbo.
Yes, she is.
Wait, no, not Robert Conrad. Wait a minute.
No,
stop
Robert
it.
Vaughn.
Not even Robert. Martin Landau,
oh, no, Martin Landau. Martin Landau twins.
Oh, wait.
Yes.
I thought she was in the one with the guy from Wild Wild West. I guess I'm wrong. My mistake.
No, she's in the one with the Martin Landau twins.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. She's Martin Landau's father's, like, basically.
Yeah, the new bride to be. Yeah. Yeah. I got to say, not to preempt our eventual Columbo show, but that might be my favorite episode.
It's got so much going for it. And I agree. I agree that Julie Newmar, she brought a lot to this episode. Like, by the end, I was like, thanks for everything.
Thanks, Julie Newmar. You really
brought this together.
Bravo.
Anyway, sorry.
I like that. But I meant that sincerely, because I really did like her.
Again, this is another one like the last episode where I was like, you know, the female lead is carrying this. She's not like, this one's a little bit more stereotypical than Nutella was, but charming, enjoyable, and the dynamic between her and Bones is fun. Like, at every, yeah. I don't know. I'm not saying, again, I'm sincere in saying also that maybe she is the thing that makes this like a watchable episode, because otherwise,
I had
a hard time. How many, DC, when I saw DC Fontana, again, this is another episode I hadn't seen in a while. Now, this one I remembered a little bit better than
the costume.
When I saw DC Fontana and Pevney, I was like, hell yeah.
Here we go.
We're going to get a well-written. Is this DC Fontana's worst episode? How redundant is it? How many times are they going to fight, get into a fist fight?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they were running out of ideas on set how to do it. Because at one point, okay, please explain to me this part. Newmar's in the cell with them. Her arm is hurt. Mm-hmm. Bones, I like.
By cell, you mean tent. But
tent, yes. Well, yeah. For all intents and purposes. Oh, Jesus. Bones, in a great Bones moment is, I'm going to fix her arm. They can only kill me once. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's some solid Hippocratic oath. But then Kirk and Spock go, that's a good idea. Yeah, it sure is. And I'm like, what exactly came of that? Because all he does is kind of walk towards her, and then Kirk throws a pillow at the guy.
No.
Let's be clear. Throws a pillow that knocks that Capellan the hell out. Like, from getting hit with a pillow, like a he falls down. Like, he flips
does
over
backwards. Does it hit
backwards.
Him? Yes. Does it even really hit him? Doesn't it just kind of glance?
It glances him. It doesn't hit him well enough.
It's like the weak way getting kicked by Luke in Return of the Jedi.
Force kick.
Yeah.
But I don't understand. So, Bones walking towards her, that was a distraction enough for them to do this.
I guess so.
It was really confusing to me.
Moment they needed. They've been waiting for that this whole time.
At least he could touch her. He's not allowed to touch her. Mm-hmm. He could touch her, and the guards could actually respond in some way first. Mm-hmm. None of that happens. He just throws the pillow, and it's like the third fist fight of the episode, 20 minutes in. And I'm like, what is with this episode? All they can think of to do is fisticuffs.
Yeah. All right. You know, I don't want to, show my hand, but here's the thing. I will say that, you know, as a simpleton, I like the action and fisticuffs heavy Star Trek episodes.
Oh, sure.
But this one is so, it's hard to believe that a guy who directed, 14 episodes of Star Trek directed this.
Maybe not. I don't know.
It does, you know, but then that's even, then the point is made even more that, like, this is such a poorly directed and edited episode. And you know, to your point, John, like, they're run out of, like, ways to do interesting fight choreography almost immediately. And the other thing is, like, you kind of have this, like, hey, here's the Kliat. Here's this kind of weird, weird throwing weapon, like, used by this, crazy war-heavy tribe. We'll introduce in the beginning, and it'll show up in the episode exactly twice. There's a lot of there's so many elements that could have made this a lot of, like, if not necessarily a great episode, at least a fun episode. Mm-hmm. And there's so many ways that it kind of just stumbles and falls with it.
Yeah. Maybe the most infuriating part of the episode, and I don't hate it necessarily, but the part that made me shake my fist at the TV was, you know, it starts off strong, like we're saying. There's a lot of world building. It's kind of cool. We are introduced to some interesting characters. And then things get really boring and everybody starts walking for a long time. And like, it kind of goes nowhere for a long time. And in the, I think it's McCoy's voiceover, he mentions in passing, oh yeah, and she doesn't want the kid. She hates the kid.
Yep.
I'm like, wait a minute, that's a story. That's you can't just drop that in like the narration and then act like you told us that.
Oh yeah,
like,
no,
where's the moment where you find that out or something?
Where they just walked to Vasquez Rocks. Yeah, like they tell you five, there's like three episode points they bring up in that narration, in that captain's log that they had not brought up here, you know, prior to that.
We had to film all those fight scenes and just, we didn't have time for dialogue and telling you the story, forget it.
Her not wanting the baby, which becomes very important, should have been an act break button.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, it should have been, we are accentuating this point, and we're going to show Bones' reaction to her saying it while the music's going, dun, 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 and then we know, hey, this is important. But instead, he's like, yeah, medical officer's log, we're walking. She doesn't want the baby. It's really hot.
As if we didn't have enough walking to do. She also doesn't want the kid, I guess. And my shoes sold with sand. And
she also has issues with her father, memories of her father. It's like, he almost like goes into like a casual, like a, you know, dictating, like a psychiatrist dictating. And it's like, that part is really important. What's important in this episode often doesn't seem to be important in the episode, if you get what I mean. Like, they're not really accentuating these things. And they fall on, they fall into action. Like, the amount of, the way they treat these fight scenes, it reminded me of being a kid and with your friends, and you're all the rebels, and the stormtroopers are all invisible, and you're just like, fight them! Oh, we got captured! Steal his blaster! And it feels like that level of intellect is behind the... And it's really disappointing, because it's just like the super team of writer-director to me. Or it's like Coon Pevney or Fantana Pevney.
And essentially, like, location, too. Like, Vasquez Rocks is such a Star Trek... That's what you said. So, like, it's like, oh, let's get the, you know, like one of the classic writers, one of the classic directors, and one of the classic locations, and we don't need to do anything else. We don't need to, like, you know, make anything happen.
Well, and again, oh, by the way, here's a trick. It's not a trick question. Here's a pop quiz question.
Pop quiz.
If Gene Roddenberry did a pass on the script, what scene do you think he added?
I think I know. The I Dream of Jeannie interlude.
If by the I Dream of Jeannie interlude you mean McCoy bitch slapping Julianne Moore, then yes.
Oh, I wasn't even thinking of that one. No. Yeah. I guess we have to talk about McCoy slapping a lady.
Right.
We do. And it's
I love it.
Slapping
so
a lady, what, twice? Three times?
I think just once. She hits him twice and he hits her
once.
But then
twice,
he plans to do it further. He's three times slap a lady.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What? No, it's bad. It's
is
gross.
It? I mean, of course it's bad.
It's not Airplane where they're like,
that's funny.
Get a hold of
yourself. Where at least it's funny. Yes, it's not that.
Spock's not standing behind her with like a pistol, and Kirk's got a boxing glove, and
I mean, I'm thinking about From Russia with Love a lot lately, and it's a little bit more like Bond slapping her in From Russia with Love on the train, and it's like I watched that with Archer and I had to tell him, oh hey Archer, you see what he just did? That's real
that.
Old-fashioned and super wrong. And he was
now
like,
did she slap him twice before he slapped her once?
He was like you got to tell me the truth. It was one of those I have a right to hit you because you're not telling me the truth kind of
no that
thing.
Is
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But you know, Archer was like, "Yeah, Dad, I know that." He's like, "Why?"
Right.
Well, good. At least you already knew that.
Yeah.
Not to hit. It's like, yeah, I guess it is really obvious, but I still feel like we should talk about it.
Yeah.
And I would say the same thing about this. Pete, did you watch this episode with your children?
One of them.
And did that moment come up?
But no, because I think we were completely distracted by something else at that point. Because we were already starting to
feel
like my, you know. My interest was waning. His was already gone. The 3-year-old was already like, you know, eating Legos at that point.
The walls.
So.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't understand her emotional motivation at all. I'm going to go play with Legos.
How do they put that plot point in the narration? Well, that's ridiculous.
Interesting that you point out that it's Roddenberry, because also, like, apparently he took out...
I mean, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah. Because it's similarly, like, so DC Fontana, in her... draft in her script, at one point Aileen, like at the end or near the end, it says that she sacrificed her child for her own life. So like rather than I don't know if it's like maybe this all suffers because of that, because it's like, oh, Roddenberry objected and changed the ending to what appears in the finished episode. So this could be, you know, Fontana was like, all right, here's a you know, strong woman making this, you know, again, I don't know if it was a, you know, pro-choice kind of message or anything like that, or anything like, I don't understand exactly how it played out, only having a little note here, but, I wonder if that tinkering just totally derailed the whole, like, if this whole end of the episode would be less boring, it probably would still have a little lull there, but once they got out to Vasquez Rocks, it might have been a more satisfying thing if there was, if they didn't have to just reinvent the whole thing. Probably not, though. I can't see it having that much of a ripple effect on the plot, other than like, oh, that's an interesting bit.
But like, how much better would this episode been if they'd kind of pulled in a mock time and really the climax was, okay, Kirk, okay, Klingon, gladiatorial deathmatch.
Right. He even teased that at the beginning where he's like, yeah, let me in the Klingon fight for fun. And I was like, do it.
And the Klingon's obviously too cowardly, which is a problem I sometimes have with original series Trek, is that, okay, they're supposed to be your main nemesis throughout the galaxy, and yet, like, they seem just cowardly and craven all the time. It's like the worst aspects of the Ferengi in Next Generation Deep Space Nine when you have original series Klingon most of the time.
Right.
Which I makes you feel like the Romulans wouldn't have been like that. Yeah. The way they set up the Romulans in Balance of Terror, had they gone with that as the primary villain, I guarantee they would have not been that way. It would have been a very jarring difference from Balance of Terror to cowardly Romulans.
Right.
So it's another place where I like Klingons, and I mean, I especially like them once they really get fleshed out in
Next Gen and Deep Space Nine and stuff. Yeah.
You always trusted them, and you always will, and you'll always forgive them for the death of your boy.
Always.
The characteristics of the Romulans in the original series kind of end up becoming, motion picture and beyond, it become not beyond the movie, but after,
sure, that was the last one,
you know, mainly in Next Gen and then all the things that follow that, like that, those, you know, like, oh, now Klingon society is all about honor and the you know, like all the structural stuff, a lot of that was ascribed to the Romulans in the original series, and then it's like, well, we've already got Romulans too, so we'll just make them a little bit different, and then now we need new craven kind of, sniveling bad guys. So let's make up a new thing. Hey, Ferengi, there you go.
Yeah, the Ferengi. That was worked. And so they were supposed to be the primary villain of Next Gen, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you're really taking this way too far. Like the craven sniveling. They have fangs, but they don't feel that dangerous. And it took them some time to figure out the villain problem on Next Gen, but they got it. I think they got it pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Can I just go back real quick and make clear that I don't think it's cool that McCoy slapped Julie Newmar, but I do think that it's not like we were saying, Alana of Troyes, like, you know, Kirk, I forget if he actually slaps her or if he just balls her out or something, but like, we were kind of like, well, okay, she's being like a 10-year-old kid. Her behavior is impeding what needs to happen and stuff. Here, McCoy is trying to, like, you know, save the life of her baby. Mm-hmm. And she's like, knock it off, I got to do my job. Right. And she's hit him twice. I'm just saying, you know,
I mean,
call it gray, call it whatever, call it the 60s. I don't know.
If one wants to do the heavy lifting on it, there is a kind of like, okay, it's a warlike culture where like shows of force equate earning respect.
Yeah. I'm just looking for any excuse to watch a guy hit a lady. That's what I'm trying to say.
But still, you don't need it in the episode, and it is jarring.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It is. And then he makes the crack about it later, like, oh, this is going to be part of my medical kit from now on or whatever, giving her a right hook
cross,
or something.
Grumbly.
Yeah.
Just an open-handed slap. It wasn't a right cross. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, clearly McCoy is not a boxing fan. And this is a very small thing. Like, do you know how long it would take to weave two bowstrings?
Yeah, really.
You do a fantastic job.
And again, like it's, you know, not that it's a huge, but it's like, all right, you two guys, like with your homemade, like, again, like, you know, 10-year-old playground bow and arrows are, you know, defeating these you know, the hardened fighting forces with their Kligats that are almost as effective as a phaser, according to the slideshow. But yeah, I don't know. It seems a little, again, it all falls apart for a bit there.
Yeah. Oh, I discovered something amazing while I was watching this episode. I usually watch the you know, re-kajiggered ones on Amazon, and I was doing that this time, and they cut back to the Enterprise, which we can talk about, the whole Enterprise excitement. Chekov is at the science station, and he's got that readout, and they've been monitoring whether or not there's a ship on the edge of their sensors, and I could see it like in the remastered, it's like, oh, they got like lines and things, stuff's happening like that. There's every once in a while I get curious about what the original looked like. So I went and I looked at the original, and not only is it, obviously just like a little dot that disappears or something, and that's all there is, but there's like a moment in the original episode where they cut away from that shot to the control panel, and it's a different, they corrected it in the remastered one, because when they cut to the control panel in the original, it's clearly like the navigation panel, and you can see the chair there and stuff. It's like it's in the wrong place, and they went through the effort to like, you know, cut in like a more accurate science station panel.
I totally
with
see
hand
it.
There and stuff. I thought that was fascinating. I love watching Star Trek
That kind of reminds me, like, did you guys notice how many of the shots didn't match, and like how it looked like it was like filmed in two different film stocks?
Yes. There were a lot of moments like that where like, oh, are they going to zoom into something or cut away, like fade away to something?
The
like
bridge,
everything's all grainy and weird now.
Yeah, on the bridge, their uniforms would be like muted color for multiple shots, and then it'd cut right in and be like that jarring, like vivid color and the gauzier, you know, it's a little gauzier when on the special, the remastered.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is going on? Did those elements, for some reason, you know, we haven't talked about this. I mean, the show was filmed, certainly shot on film.
Right.
And it's like, did those film elements not transfer correctly? Like, were they just not for those specific shots? Because you'll watch an old movie sometime and it'll be in HD, right? And they'll have transferred it, except for like one real or something. It's bizarre. It'd be like, for whatever reason, they could not save that reel, and it'll be right in the middle of the movie. It'll suddenly be all grainy and weird.
Yeah.
And I felt like that's what was happening here. I couldn't figure out why else it would be like that.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. It was strange.
Reading that, you read that thread recently about Citizen Kane, the restoration of Citizen Kane, where they were like, there's one part where they like, they just don't have a good version of it. Mm-hmm. And like,
yeah.
There's no, you know, the negatives were lost. There's no, like, all the prints are kind of, there's no good, there's no good Citizen Kane out there.
Nah. I remember when Citizen Kane first came out on DVD, my mind was blown that I could actually see the reporter's face.
Right.
Yeah, wait a minute.
No, I'll still occasionally watch something that I watched a million times on TV, and I'll see it in HD now, and it's like,
oh, yeah.
It's like shocking what you can see, and including, again, I'll say again from Russia with Love, when she I should know her name, but we've just started covering that movie, so I'm
Daniela or something, I forget, like the actress's name versus the character's name, but
when she comes into Bond's hotel room and slides into bed and he sees her through the curtain, you can see all of her butt. Like, complete nudity. And I was like, what? There's no way that was the way it was on the video or on ABC.
This is the high-minded cinema.
I'm just saying, that's the kind of thing, though, that
silhouette butt.
When I saw that show, when I saw From Russia with Love on TV, that would have been super exciting. Like, when it was the age I watched
Much
it.
Better
and now I'm bomb. Like,
right. Yeah, that's the nude bomb you're looking for.
Yeah.
I just found the nude bomb. I wonder if you watch the nude bomb now in 4K,
totally
there's
movie.
Actually lots of nudity in it.
You know, it just occurs to me, I have the Blu-ray of the nude bomb. I haven't watched it yet.
Oh,
I
should please report out. Back.
Yeah.
Don't report back too much. Just report back.
Well, I will. I'll follow that up with the first time that I, you know, we upgraded our, many years ago, I upgraded our projector at home and then got a granted, it was special edition, obviously, you know, like, but the first time I watched Star Wars in HD, my wife came home to find me like standing up, touching the wall, like, you know, just like with tears in my eyes, just like my hand up against
with it.
Yeah.
I remember.
I tried to V'ger it. I was like, take me into whatever this is.
I remember
as
getting
much
that,
as you wanted to make dinner. I want this.
Yeah.
The widescreen VHS came out in like 95 or so.
Yeah.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
The ones with the heads on the packaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had that. I still have it, actually, the flat box and everything. Mm-hmm. I'd seen the movie in the theater in the early 80s, right? But it hadn't been back to the theater in a long time, as far as I knew. And I watch it, and I remember just being absolutely floored that you can see C-3PO like shut down Obi-Wan's.
Yeah,
I was just like, wait, you could actually just see him. He's just sitting there. I was being so excited by that.
There's that guy in The Empire Strikes Back, like Vader's talking to somebody via hologram, and there's a guy, like an extra guy on the side, who's reacting because you just saw in the exterior shot that the ship's getting hit by an asteroid. I hadn't seen that in 20 years at the time.
Even little things like the Skywalker land speeder.
Right, yeah.
Like you can't really, you couldn't really see in the pan and scan version.
Right,
like,
especially on VHS and whatever.
Yeah, on VHS especially.
You mean the family speeder, not the family. Right.
Sorry, I bungled up my tongue. What did I say?
No. I just clarified. Skywalker. No. I was just clarifying it for myself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said it right. So many things. It's great to see. And I want to tell you folks, those of you that are listening, like, is this a Star Trek podcast? This is what happens when episodes are really dull.
Yeah.
We talk about other things because I don't know what to talk about. I will say this.
Okay.
There is a, I'm a doctor, not an escalator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get in this episode. Not bad.
That my son
Except
did
he
like.
Is an escalator of domestic violence. Oh. Unfortunately. Hey. That wasn't funny. I'm sorry.
Well, usage of escalator, and we're all proud of you for that.
No. I think we should cut that. That was, it's not funny to joke about domestic violence at all.
There's so many, like I said, there's so many ways that this could have been like a super fun, at least B episode. Mm-hmm. And even like an A episode, like you actually have an interesting tribe of people. The Capellans, is that their name?
Yeah.
They're very compelling.
Yeah. But they're like, there's.
Cut that.
A lot of picks of like Native Americans. A lot of picks off of like Native American tribes. A lot of picks off like ancient Mongolians. Like, there's a lot of fun stuff to do with that. The idea of like Kirk and Spock having to fight with primitive weaponry, against like a group, like a hunting party. Basically, there's a lot of fun in that. Even though if you're watching the series in alphabetical order, we just saw an episode where the Federation and the Klingon Empire are kind of trying to anti-diplomacy each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's fun to see, but nothing holds together. And like, even like kind of like the little things, like, do you still have your magnesium tablet? Of course I do. Pink. Right. And everything is so poorly directed. Everything, like all the action sequences are so like, amateurishly, as you said earlier, John, like kiddily done, like I'm going to stab you in what's 2 feet away from your actual body.
and you're going to go, it's all like pretend. Sometimes it happens when you're watching a movie, you'll be like, why does this feel like pretend?
It's like playground, and that's what like you said.
The thing where Kraz goes over to the Capellan and he gets the phaser, but then he takes out his knife and then kind of like half stabs him, but like he just like put he like pokes it
that's
near
exactly
him and
what
he's
I was
like, talking
about.
Yeah. That
yeah.
like
yeah.
That, well, the whole thing is like rife with those where it's just like, it's not really like a,
there's an amazing moment. And I want this explained to me. There's a shot though, like a bit like the Capellans are coming over the hill and our guys are hidden behind some rocks. So we see them down here and the guys are coming from the top of the screen and stuff. And it's like a big wide shot of all these guys marching and the Klingon trips and falls. You see him tripping. And I thought, I was like, it's a funny little thing that I noticed. But then they cut to a closer thing. And the Klingon is still falling and getting up and like dusting himself off. And in my heart, I want that to be that he fell in that wide shot. They didn't feel like doing it again. So they had him fall in the close up and be dusting himself off and stuff.
Was that an accident or were they trying to make a point? Like, look at that Klingon. He's wimpy.
Yeah. He can't swing with these guys. He's a big loser. Yeah.
There was a note about that on here that I was trying to find.
Oh, awesome.
Now I can't find it, but there's a... Tig Andrews takes a face-forward flop onto the ground. In the next close-up, he's seen in the background getting up, and after a cutaway, comes to the foreground and dusts off his pants. This would seem to indicate that for the close-up coverage, there was a second camera filming simultaneously to the wide shot, and that the camera was hidden behind the large rock seen near Michael Dante. So that might have been intentional, but it was filmed kind of twice.
Yeah. Or it happened accidentally in both angles.
And they just happened to have coverage on it. So like, oh, good, we'll use that. That makes us like him less.
Yeah. I think the biggest disappointment in this episode, I already said what the biggest one was, but this is still the biggest. Hmm. I get so excited. I know we all do. We all get so excited when Scotty has the con.
Yeah.
When he's in, cause he's a rock. He handles everything. He's awesome. He's nobody's dummy. And in this one, he's kind of somebody's dummy. And like, even when he gets smart, like there's a distress signal. We got to go investigate it. So we have to leave here, leave the landing party and go investigate this distress signal, which of course turns out to be fake. And like 7 hours after they've proven that it's fake, they decide to turn around and stuff. It just takes forever for Scotty to actually get smart. And it drives me insane. I really don't like that.
And it feels like in the writing, it feels like in the writing, they want you to think Scotty's smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, we'll stay out here for just enough time after they establish it's 99%.
Now that I've figured it out, we'll just hang out.
They've 100% figured out it's fake.
Yeah, they've proven it. Yeah.
They've proven it. Now, mind you, Scotty's the one that figured it out. So he was the guy that figured it out. But then Uhura just goes, yeah, but it could be real. It's like, well, then we'll stay for a while.
It's like they need them to not get back to the landing party right away. I get that. But they could just say, okay, we're heading back immediately. Mm-hmm. And we, the audience, don't know how long it takes for them to get back.
It's TV time. You know,
hightail it back to the thing. We'll be there as soon as we can.
Nobody's going to go at warp speed. They can go. Well, wait, they probably
would.
And there's enough writerly workarounds. Like, I don't know, this doesn't sound official, but regulation state, we have to help a ship in distress. So there's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. That would satisfy me. I'd be happy with that. Like, regulation state, we have to spend 45 minutes until we can absolutely confirm there's no distress. There's no real distress signals.
Yeah.
It's not the best, but it works better than, oh, we'll wait just as much time as we have to.
Right.
See, I do like when the second fake call comes in and he just gives it the finger. He's like, nope. Yeah.
Not answering.
He was... He was so self-assured it was time to leave. Scotty was like, I remember thinking, this is one of those times when I'm watching people who are decisive and in authority, and I'm always like, how are they like that?
That must be great.
Where he was like, there's a ship in distress, and that's what our priority is, and that's that. And I'm like, he's like third in command on this ship, and he's very knowledgeable about what they should do right now.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, God, I don't know. What should we? The captain's down there. Should we go? So I'm like real impressed when somebody's like that. I'm like, how does he know that? Like, is that something they tell you? Do you have to memorize all these scenarios? Or
is there like a flow chart that just tells you what to do? Because I would need that.
I would definitely need that. I'd probably need somebody to explain the flow chart to me.
Right. Hang on, everybody.
Are any of you guys experts in a ancient Earth dialect that I just wasn't familiar with?
Yes. That was one of my notes, was Uchi Wuchi Kuchi Koo, which should be, can we sample that and turn that into a song? I don't know.
Oh, easily.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Rock and roll Uchi Kuchi
Kuchi Koo.
Was that Rick Derringer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the Hulk Hogan theme thing?
Yeah, same guy.
No, a real American theme.
Yeah. Well, at the time, it was for Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda.
And
but
Barry
Windham.
Yeah.
Anyway.
U.S. Express.
The it's a bit goofy. And I do like, you know, it adds a little bit of like, at the end, I was like, you know, a little bit cringe, a little bit eye-rolly, but I was like, oh, okay, here's a little bit of Star Trek that I know. It's like the two of them, especially with the bit that like, they name the child, Leonard James Akar, who, you know, last episode we were like, oh, there's so many like things here that they could follow up on. There was like one book, but apparently like this episode has been mined for a lot of ancillary materials, and they as a kind of in joke continuity, etc., whatever, but they in the Deep Space Nine books, they've referenced this revered, influential Admiral Leonard James Akkar. So, like, they, like, at the end of this, they're like, oh, that's God. A name that's going to go places. And then, like, he does, like, Ian,
hey,
but not you. Not directly, I don't think. But,
oh, that's funny.
That's funny.
And he's his profile photo on Memory Alpha is a cute little baby. So it's a. Aww. I wonder who played him. Does it say?
Oh,
played by unknown Sophia performer.
Oh. Oh, him.
Do we? I actually don't know what happens at the end of this episode. Why does Mike Pence give himself up at the end? Like, he's immediately like, my life is forfeit because of some reason, and he goes and gets himself Klingoned. I miss why that happened.
My guess, and it seemed really lazy and poorly chopped together, was basically once the Klingon pointed his phasers at the tribe, that's when he realized that, like, he was taken in by, you know, he let a snake into his tent, basically.
Mm. Yeah, I thought the party that I align myself with is proven to be untrustworthy, and then where trust is like a huge thing to them, they mentioned a bunch of times.
I backed the wrong horse.
Yeah, so once he realized, like, oh, this guy is a liar, and you know, not honorable.
Yeah.
Then he's like, let's take him out.
Okay.
You think there could be a better way is to take him out, but instead he just walks out. And is like, yeah, what about that?
The important thing is the episode ends.
I wonder, like, you know, next. Once it's safe to go be around people again, that would be a fun thing to do. Cosplay as Mob and just walk into the middle of a Star Trek convention, onto the floor of a Star Trek convention, and go, Klingon! And see how many of them get it and you know, disrupt you.
Yeah, how many new best friends you make.
Yeah, exactly. Although it does, completely inappropriate, so never mind. Makes me think of a thing that I'm not going to talk about from Kentucky Fried Movie.
oh my God. Enough said.
Because that would be Wong.
One thing that I do like from this movie that I don't feel like we get a lot is the background chatter on the Enterprise Bridge. Mm-hmm. Here's a positive from this movie. When they're doing their thing, you hear in the background, like, Enterprise System Green 321, in the back. And I was like, oh, we don't get that a lot. And it seems like there would be a lot of that. That would be a busy soundscape, the Enterprise Bridge. But we don't normally get a lot of that. But they mixed in a little bit here.
Yeah, I actually did. I was listening to it. I was watching it on my computer right before we started recording, watching it a little bit more. And I was wearing my headphones that I'm wearing right now. And I took off the right earpiece because I was like, is there some, what am I hearing? I was in the house. Yeah. And it was like mixed in the right channel. Yeah.
That's cool.
That's good. Yeah, for sure.
Was it background chatter specifically? Because I thought, I was wondering whether it was background chatter or whether it was the distress signal just kind of playing on loop in the background.
Oh. I'll say, I don't know what it was. It was a sound. I wouldn't say it was chatter exactly, but I was hearing something and it was just like, is there something in my
kitchen?
You heard
a sound. You turned around to see the thing that made the sound.
Yeah.
And it was not there. It was on the a television show.
It was a mysterious whisper.
It was
what you were hearing.
It was background chatter because I had the subtitles on too, and it was saying stuff, you know, about, like, you know, Enterprise level one, whatever. And it seemed busy people doing busy stuff in the crew.
Yeah.
But just coming over the intercom kind of.
Get you pushed to zero.
One more thing about this is chronologically the first time that Chekhov mistakenly, quote unquote, declares something to be a Russian invention.
Oh, okay.
And
it was so funny they kept on doing it.
Exactly.
Oh, it worked so perfectly.
Does he not do it in a mock time? That's the second season opener. I thought he did. I know he gets a speech, but I thought there was something referencing like Moscow as. Or maybe it's he makes a Russian reference that is real. That's the other
part. That might be a real one.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think he does.
Oh, he could.
I can't remember.
Let me see. Hang on. I'm not going to. I just read it on there, and I was like, oh, that's a fun thing to talk about. And then I lost it. So
you've ruined the episode.
I did have an. I'm
sure space sickness was invented by Yuri Gagarin.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Which actually does make sense.
That is true.
or that dog.
Yeah.
That nobody ever made nobody ever wrote a joke like, ah, when I was raised by my three sisters. Like, Fred, always disappointed.
um, There is another, while I was looking for that, I found this other thing that I forgot was a fun, oh, here it goes. So this is the first episode in which Chekhov makes a dubious claim of something being invented in Russia. So, which in this case, he's talking about, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. He says that was, yes, that saying comes from Russia. Yeah. And then he does so with a smirk, suggesting he may only be teasing. So maybe it's always a lie.
Oh, and he actually says that devil. Phrase was invented in Russia, which is real. Right. Like, I don't think a phrase is just being invented.
No, you coin it.
Well, there's a guy with a patent. He's got the patent on the phrase.
Yeah, he's got a diagram of the phrase, pinpointing like all the details of it. Yeah,
it's like a blueprint figure one. I like that idea.
There was something. I just scrolled past it again. Oh, this is the first, chronologically again, this is the first time we see Sulu's pop-up scanner.
That
was actually like kind of cool when they went to battle stations.
Do not cut away until that thing's all the way up. That thing's neat.
This is not the thing that I was just looking for, but also it's the first episode where we get all seven classic crew members. So all the people who signed to the end of Star Trek VI, they're all in the same room at the same time for the first time here.
Wow.
They're in the
cool. Is Uhura not? Is Scotty or Uhura not in Amok Time?
They're all in the episode, but this is the first time they're all in the same room together in the briefing room when they're doing
take a picture and sell it
for McCoy's slideshow.
Calendar. Yeah.
And there was one. Wait, I just scrolled past something else. And now this is how everybody likes to hear on a podcast is people scrolling.
Talking about looking at the internet.
Oh, this is what it was. So remember a couple of episodes ago, back in the E's, remember the letter E? It looks kind of like an F, but it's missing the leg at the bottom. Errand of Mercy, we were like, oh, how come Bones isn't in this episode? Well, that would be fun to go see what mission he's on. And that, like, people have said, like, oh, well, it's possible because of the uniform that he's wearing, and it's not a 2265 Starfleet uniform, so, like,
oh my god,
that means he's stationed on the planet either before he was the Enterprise's chief medical officer, or it could be that the duration of his assignment on Capella was only a few months. It's possible that he was temporarily transferred to Capella 4 during one or both of the episodes that he doesn't appear in.
Wow.
We'll get to the other one way later, but it's funny that so Errand of Mercy, where we were like, oh, what's McCoy doing during all this? It could very well have been he was visiting the Capellans. So I like that continuity.
Yeah.
Anyway, as far as what I classify this as, it's it's not the newly coined Bowen's episode because there's not really love there.
Mm-hmm. No.
But I think it is the much maligned engineering category where it's just like there's some stuff here, but it's a bit of a mess. It really needs work. It's not a total loss because there's good world building and there's the characters that we like doing stuff. But like somebody should have watched this before we aired it, huh? So I'm gonna call it an engineering episode because it needs the work, not just Scotty's in charge the whole time, which is another whole.
Is he?
Now, what is your letter grade for this?
It's tough because it starts out okay, so I can't. It's not a total failure. It's not, you know, I watched it for the most part. I did start checking my phone and eating Legos with my son for a bit in the near the end there, or
why
middle end.
What? You were eating Lego?
He was. Like, I was.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
You were delicious. Just serving it to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a bad father, my God.
Shut up and eat your Legos.
You're not going anywhere until that plate of Legos is empty. Yeah.
Make a stick of broccoli out of it and then eat it.
Very expensive food that you would have if you were.
Anyway. And none of those off-brand, you know, building bricks or whatever. It's
I don't know if you guys know this. Pete is really, really rich.
Very rich and cruel.
He's got a deal with the Lego company.
So I don't know. I have a hard time. I want to get, like, my heart right now says C-, because I really just lost it completely during parts of it. And it's got enough that it's like, all right, it's not a total failure because it's not alternative factor where it's just like, what's going on here? It's enough that it's like, okay, there's some things, but I mean, I could be talked into going lower. I would have a hard time getting talked into going higher. But for some reason, I don't want to totally be harsh. I feel like there were parts of it that I liked at the beginning mainly, and I'll go C-.
I'm exactly right with you. Like everything you just said is pretty much what I was thinking I was going to say. I think the thing except that the keeps it from being, except for the part about eating Legos, though I might try it later. The thing that keeps this from being in the D category for me is Numar and that character and the dynamic between her and Bones. Otherwise, there's just not very much to like about this. I will say we did not mention there was one shining Pevney moment, though. Do you guys know which one it was? Kirk on the ground.
Swords
come into frame. Pevney touch right there. That's a beautiful shot.
That was nice.
And I can't remember. Is this after Barbarella? Because Barbarella has that famous moment.
I think of Barbarella at 68, but that doesn't mean I'm right.
Yeah, I don't remember when Barbarella, but there's that famous shot. I remember it being in a like a film textbook with where there's all the swords and stuff that are like framing them in the middle. And anyway, beautiful. So one Pevney, great Pevney moment. Julie Newmar keeps it in the C's, but man, this was just not a very good episode. And I'll give it a little bit of credit. And it's got the escalator. You know, it's got a doctor. I'm not a doctor joke. That helps. C minus.
I'm not Did you say D minus or D. C minus?
C minus.
What?
Kept it out of the D zone.
Okay.
Okay.
C minus.
Because of Newmar.
C is for Cookie.
It looks like Barbarella was 1968. A shot in 67 came out in 68, it looks like. So.
They can't have seen. They can't they have can't seen have Barbarella. Seen
this episode, right.
Before they should.
First, this was shot during 67, it looks like. So, no.
So Pevney was right there with Jane Fonda's French filmmaker husband, whose name is
Roger Vadim.
Yeah, Vadim.
Roger Vadim. There.
Vadim, right?
Vadim.
I think it was just Vadim, right? You're supposed to just call him by Vadim.
Oh.
Anyway,
cinematographer so Pevney, Vadim,
from the same cut from the same cloth. I hope Pevney had the same lifestyle as Roger Vadim. Anyway,
I was just like, oh, Claude Renoir. So the cinematography on Barbarella is like, oh, Claude Renoir. Wait, I just looked him up not too long ago. Like, why does that sound familiar? Because he's the nephew of Jean Renoir and the grandson of, you know, the painter Renoir. And I was like, I just saw his name not too long ago. What did he do? And he was also a cinematographer on The Spy Who Loved Me. Yeah. That's why. Over the summer, I watched all the Bond movies when he was talking about them. So Barbarella and Spy Who Loved Me, cinematographer.
Did he have a son? Now I'm really interested in what his son
Friday's
did.
Child.
Chain of Renoirs.
I do not see. Oh, he went blind.
Oops. Mm. Instead of having a son?
Yeah. Oh, he was married twice and had two children, a son and a daughter. Actress Sophie Renoir.
Okay.
So that's his daughter, Sophie Renoir.
Not the son. I just wanted more son. I just wanted to see this lineage be just insane.
Yeah.
Renoir, the painter.
Sophie Renoir is the great granddaughter of the painter, the daughter of the cinematographer, granddaughter of the actors Pierre Renoir and Vera Sergine, and the grandniece of director Jean Renoir. And in 1988, she was nominated for a César Award for Most Promising Actress for her part in Boyfriends and Girlfriends. And that seems to be the last movie that she did. So, All right.
Well, so getting back to the grading.
Yeah. Where are we?
Yeah.
It's like 90 degrees right now.
I'm going to also go with the C minus, and my reasoning for going to the C minus as opposed to lower is despite all my complaints, which are myriad. I have to admit, it is an episode of Star Trek that truly embedded itself into me as a kid. Like, I clearly knew the Kliat, and I clearly knew the
Kliat!
whatever reason, using the, you know, making the bow and arrow, like, really stuck in my head. And, you know, as I got older, obviously, like, recognizing that a Catwoman's in the episode doesn't hurt either.
No.
But, yeah, but, I mean, it's still... It's weird. It sort of like has something to it, but it's something that's squandered.
Yeah.
Something squandered. Friday's Child.
I agree with everybody here. All my esteemed co-hosts. C-minus.
C-minus?
Across the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
There being anything as C-minuses across the board.
Yeah. I do. I'm charmed to death by Julie Newmar. I'm charmed by Bones in a lot of the spots in this episode, and I want to be charmed by Scotty, but I'm not, because he's not as smart as he should be. But yeah, it's everything you guys said. C minus. McCoy.
McCoy.
I'm trying to only see, McCoy. Like, are there other times where we all had the exact same grade? And
Oh, exact same grade, maybe.
There's a time I copied off of John.
There's been lots of A pluses.
Oh, we all gave everybody an A plus. No. For,
well, Amok Time and City on the Edge are both A pluses across the board. But
even going back to Devo, I don't think we've ever all had C minuses at the same time.
Yeah, it's a funny grade because it's where we're like, well, we don't want to fail it completely. Like it's like we didn't like this, but we have a little bit of heart here for some reason.
Everybody gave Enterprise Incident a solid A.
Oh, there you go. I thought you were joking at first. And I was like, oh, no, there it is.
Which Enterprise incident are you even talking about?
The one where there was a thing that happened with the Enterprise.
Well,
that one.
Guess what?
Yeah.
We're done with the Fs.
Oh, my God.
Get out of here, Fs. Get the F out.
F you.
Just like when those pandas sued the World Wrestling Federation. We have... Now we're on to the Gs, and just like the Fs, there are two Gs.
All right.
And I have,
two Gs.
Spoiler alert, I've got soft spots for both of these Gs.
Mm. Oh.
But
I bet I do too.
First up, and again, I'm going to save it for next week. But first up, the Galileo 7, which is from season one. That'll be our next episode. So stick with us again. If you like to hear all kinds of, we did a lot of rambling this episode. If you want to hear more stuff like that, the Patreon is, abcdtos.com/Patreon. And you can support us there. We do episodes where we kind of ramble and loosely based around episodes of the animated series, but, boy, does it go places. you can check that out there. Also, follow us on Twitter at ABCDTOS, the ABCDTOS Briefing Room on Facebook. And hopefully, you'll be back for the G's next week here on ABCDTOS.
Pew pew!
Clear!
Clear!
Klieg at.